Last week we started into marriage, and I talked about how God set up marriage, God defines marriage, who can be married and who can't be, and he set it up as an institution that's lifelong, so you can't, once you're in, you can't get out of it, with two exceptions being adultery and desertion of an unbeliever. And then I ended up talking about how marriage is for most people but not for all, and that some people do have the gift of celibacy. And now I want to get into the fact that since God created marriage, he also reserves the right to regulate the relationship within marriage. And I want to talk first of all about the roles and the responsibilities of the wives in marriages. And I start here, I start with the wife, because God starts with the wife. If you look in Ephesians 5, Colossians 3, and 1 Peter 3, and we'll read all these three passages, you'll see each time it's curious that it's God starts off with the wife. He always starts off wives. Why he does that, I'm not altogether sure, but the fact is he does it, so I figure if he starts off with the women, then I'll start off with the women too. So we'll read these three passages and then get into the rest of the study. These passages, these three, really will be the core text for this study today and next week, largely as well. Ephesians 5, 22 through 23. God starts off here, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it, that he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that he might present it to himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth his wife loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it even as the Lord the church, for we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband." So in this text, he starts with the wives and he ends with the wives. We see likewise in Colossians, just a couple pages over in Colossians 3, 18 through 19, Paul once again starts with the wives. He says in Colossians 3, 18 and 19, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord. Husbands, love your wives and be not bitter against them." And this is not limited to Paul. Peter likewise, whenever he writes to Christians concerning marriage, he likewise starts off with the ladies. 1 Peter 3 and verse 1 through 7. It says, "Likewise, ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of the wives, while they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. Whose adorning, let it not be that outward adorning of plaiting of hair or of wearing of gold or of putting on of apparel. But let it be the hidden man of the heart, in that which is not corruptible, even the ornament of a meek and quiet spirit, which is in the sight of God of great price. For after this manner, in the old time, the holy women also, who trusted in God, adorned themselves, being in subjection unto their own husbands, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well and are not afraid with any amazement. Likewise ye husbands, dwell with them according to knowledge, giving honor unto the wife, as unto the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers be not hindered." So once again, Peter starts off with the wife, and he spends a lot more time with the women than he does the men. And that, unfortunately, I'm going to spend probably a little more time with the women than I do with the men, because as you just read in these passages, the Bible does. So I just have more material to cover there for whatever reason. So I will spend today and a little bit of the beginning of next Sunday on the ladies, and then I'll get to the men. So none of you are going to get away without unscathed. So wives are to submit to their own husbands. In Ephesians 5 and verse 22, like I said, a lot of what I'm going to talk about is going to come from these three passages that I just read. And I'm going to break it down. I'm going to define terms. I'm going to go point by point and word by word and dig out everything of it that I can, because I think this is an important topic. So Ephesians 5:22 says, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord." And Colossians 3:18 likewise says very similar thing. Colossians 3:18 says, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord." Now, to submit means to place oneself under the control of a person in authority or power, to become subject, surrender oneself, or yield to a person or his rule, etc. That's just a nasty word, isn't it? Nobody likes that word. Wives or people in general, we all are under authority, under some type of authority, whether it's our boss or our husband or the preacher or the governor or the police officer or whatever. All of us are under authority. Your parents, obviously. And nobody likes that word, submit, to place oneself under the control of a person in authority. And, I mean, it starts off with babies, literally. Little David, he does not like to submit to authority. He doesn't. Just ask him. You know, you tell him to do something, he says, "My will be done, not thy will be done." He wants to do it his own way. And it starts at the youngest age. We do not like somebody else telling us what to do. Nobody likes that. It's just part of our fallen human nature. But to submit is to put yourself under the control of a person. Well, control, in the noun form, is the fact of controlling or of checking and directing action, the function or power of directing or in regulating, domination, command, sway. I'm up here talking about male domination. You know, everybody loves me for that one. But you see there that control is the fact of controlling or checking and directing action. So there's two different aspects in control. It's directing, which is telling you where you should go, and it's checking, which means not allowing you to go where you want to go. And that's part of a husband's duty and a wife's duty to submit to her husband, is that he needs to show her, to tell her where she should go. And I don't mean every little thing, tell her, you know, where you walk, where you, you know, what outfit you wear today or something like that. But in general, the husband directs where the wife and the family goes, and he also puts a check on where he doesn't want the wife and the family to go. Sometimes wives have an idea of what they think that they should do, and maybe a husband has a different idea of what he thinks she should do and the family should do. And ultimately, he's the one that has the control. We see that to control was to check. To check, the verb form is to restrain, control. It's to stop, action, growth, exhibition of feeling, and the like. To stay the course of, to repress or restrain. So sometimes, husbands, you have to restrain things that your wives may want to do. They may want to go out there and sign themselves on to a car loan for a new car, and you say, "No, we can't afford that. We're not doing that." You know, that is your prerogative, and that's what you need to do. That's why God has given you the reins. Why? Now I want you to notice something. There's a little three-letter word in both of those passages. In Ephesians 5:22 and in Colossians 3:18, it says wives are supposed to submit to their own husbands. Their own, little three-letter word. That tells me that they're not supposed to submit just to husbands. It doesn't say, "Wives, submit yourselves unto husbands," like you submit to every man that's out there. Any man out there tells you what to do, or you pick which husband out there that you think that you should go with his idea of what the rule of the home should be, and that's how you're going to conduct yourself in the home because somebody else's husband thinks something and you like that idea better. That doesn't work that way. You're supposed to submit to your own husband. Each husband will have a different leadership style and different rules and standards he sets for his wife. And, ladies, you're the one that said, "I do." You're the one that yoked yourself up with that man, and you're stuck with his rules and how he wants things done. And maybe some other husband is more lenient or more strict, and you may like either of those conditions, but you have the husband you have, and you need to submit to him. Each wife must submit to the authority of her husband, not another woman's husband. Yeah, I already said that, which have different rules, so I got ahead of myself. Sometimes I put these little notes in here because I don't want to forget to say something, and then I say it anyway, and then didn't realize that I already put it in there. So anyway, wives are supposed to submit to their husbands as unto the Lord in Ephesians 5 and verse 22. Just wanted to get that phrase, wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. So God tells us what to do is to submit. How to do it is unto the Lord. That's how you submit, as unto the Lord. That little word as there is very important, little two-letter word. As means, it speaks of a quantity or degree, and it means in which degree, to what extent. So when he says, wives, submit yourselves unto your husbands as unto the Lord, he's saying, submit yourselves unto your husband to the extent and degree that you submit to the Lord. Now, obviously, God is in control of all things, and your husband doesn't have the same authority that God does. But then again, your husband's not supposed to demand anything from you that God would forbid or wouldn't allow, so you're submitting unto him as unto the Lord to the same extent and degree, because he's supposed to be telling you to do what God says to do. And I'll get into that a little bit more here. A woman should submit to the Lord by keeping his commandments, which is how she shows the Lord that she loves him. Remember what Jesus said in John 14:15, if you love me, keep my commandments. That's how all of us show the Lord that we love him. We submit to him, we do what he says. The Lord's commandments are not grievous. Remember what it said there in 1 John? Turn to 1 John 5 and verse 3. 1 John 5 and verse 3. Wives are supposed to submit to their husbands as unto the Lord. Well, the Lord's commandments are not grievous. It says, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not grievous. So remember that, husbands. Your commandments to your wives, should not be grievous. You don't just make up rules on a whim because you can. You know, that's the kind of person that nobody likes to submit to and that everybody, quite frankly, hates. You know, what would you think if I, as your preacher, because I have the oversight, just decided on a whim, I'm just going to start making up stuff, you know, and telling you that I want you to wear blue on the first Sunday of every month or whatever. Obey them that have the rule over you. You know, I have the authority, and I just start making up all these rules that there's no reason to make up. There'd be no good reason. You know, you guys would hate me for it, and I wouldn't blame you. I'd hate me too. So, you know, husbands, don't make up grievous rules just because you can. Nothing in God's word is froward or perverse, and neither should there be any such thing in a husband's rule. Look at Proverbs 8 and verse 8. I thought it was cold in here last time. It's even colder this time. You know, I have on my weather app, on my iPod, you can put, you know, any area you want. And I have the North Pole on there. And it was actually colder here this morning than it is in the North Pole this morning. Believe it or not, I'm not even making that up. So anyway, it's freezing. I think it may be a little bit colder in here than it is outside right now. Let's see, it feels like it. Anyway, Proverbs 8. In verse 8, says, all the words of my mouth are in righteousness. There is nothing froward or perverse in them. So wives, if you're supposed to submit to your husbands as unto the Lord, well, God's commandments don't have anything froward or perverse in them. So your husband's commandments should not have anything froward or perverse in them. If a husband requires something of his wife, which God forbids, or if he forbids something which God requires, she must obey God and not her husband. That's the general commandment that we're all under, that we ought to obey God rather than men. So, husbands, your authority is limited. You only have authority which God grants you, and if you go above and beyond that and you require something of your wife that God forbids, or the other way, then she doesn't have to submit to that. In Acts 5 and verse 29, then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. So that's a commandment that every one of us should remember in every area of life. If any man, no matter who he is telling you to do something that God says not to do, or he's refusing to allow you to do something which God says to do, that's when you must not submit anymore. And it goes that way with husbands and wives as well. Wives are supposed to submit to their husbands as it is fit in the Lord. Did you notice that in Colossians 3 and verse 18? Like I said, I'm just going through here and I'm getting every little word because all these little words have important meanings. Colossians 3 and verse 18 said, "Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as it is fit in the Lord." Now, fit is well adapted or suited to the conditions or circumstances of the case, answering the purpose, proper or appropriate. So the wife should submit to her husband as long as it is proper and appropriate according to the Scriptures. So it all comes back to the Scriptures, and wives should be well versed in the Scriptures, just like the husband. And if the husband says something or tells the wife to do something or makes some policy in the home, and you're looking in the Scriptures and you're like, that really doesn't add up, that doesn't make sense. I mean, you'd be wise to say, hey hubby, look here, you know, I just want you to see what this says, and what do you think of this? You know, this seems to kind of go against what you've said here. Is this really fit in the Lord? Is this suitable? Is this appropriate? So, and a wife would be within her rights to bring something up like that to her husband. And a wise husband would certainly want to hear his wife's opinion, especially if she's pointing him to a verse on something like that. You'd be a fool not to want to hear somebody else's opinion when they may know something that you don't, even if it's somebody that you are in authority over. Now, the husband is the head of the wife. Ephesians 3 and verse 23, or Ephesians 5 and verse 23. Since for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. So the idea that the husband is the head carries a lot of weight with it. There's a lot that is bundled up inside of that idea of being the head. And I'm going to define some terms here to show you what I mean. A head, when you're speaking in the figurative sense, when you're not talking about the thing that's on top of your neck, a head is a person to whom others are subordinate, a chief, captain, commander, ruler, leader, principal person, head man. That's what a husband is to the wife. He's the chief, he's the captain, he's the commander or the ruler. You got a really important husband, you have an important position. I mean, you may not be an authority over anybody else in this world, but at least in your house, you're the captain and the commander. You have a lot of authority. And don't screw it up. I mean, you have a solemn responsibility that's more important than any other responsibility anywhere to make sure that your ship, your house, your home, and your family is sailing in the right direction. You have a big responsibility there. A commander is one who commands. It's one who commands or orders anything. And once again, we don't like this idea. We don't like somebody commanding us, telling us to do something. We like people suggesting things, you know. Nobody likes to be commanded. But it's not really true. If you have a leader who's a good leader and has your best interest at heart, people don't mind, and sometimes people even like being commanded. It's just nice to have somebody just to tell me what to do. There's times when you have a really difficult decision to make. Sometimes you just want somebody else just to tell you what to do. Just say, do this. You're like, okay, I don't have to make the decision. Thank you. I'm just going to do it. And people, the older they get, they're like that. I notice my own parents are getting to be like that. And of course, grandparents too. The older you get, you don't want to make decisions anymore, and you start calling up your kids and asking them what you should do. And the roles reverse. You know, the kids used to call you up and ask you what to do, and then you start calling them and asking them what to do because you just don't like to make decisions anymore. It's just part of getting older. A captain is one who stands at the head of others and leads them or exercises authority over them. A head man, chief, or leader. The husband is the captain and the commander of his wife and family. Now, Abraham, the prototypical man of faith, Abraham, he was a prime example of one such person. God chose him because he would command his children and his household. That is one of the reasons why God chose that man who has gone down in history as the man of faith. If you look in Genesis 18 and verse 19, this is why I say this is so important. If you're going to be a good, if you're a good husband, you have accomplished a major feat if you are one that commands your household and is a good leader. In Genesis 18 and verse 19, this is God saying this. God says, "For I know him, for he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he hath spoken of him." Yep, that's why, that's one of the reasons why God chose Abraham and blessed him. Because he knew him, that he would command his children and his household after him. He was a man of authority. Now, Lot, on the other hand, he was viewed by his family not as a head, not as a commander, but as a joke. You look at Lot and Abraham. They were, and Lot was his nephew, and they're traveling together, and they split ways. Lot chooses the, you know, the nice place to live where all the Sodomites are, but business is good there. You know, Abraham chooses another place, let Lot choose, and then Abraham went to a different place, which might not have had quite so good business, but he didn't have the filthy conversation that was going to vex his soul from day to day. Abraham was a wiser man than Lot. And Lot just made one foolish decision after another, and when the angels finally come to him, and the Sodomites are trying to come in and sodomize the angel, Lot's idea was, hey, don't harm these angels, please. Take my daughters instead. You know, what a great guy. So anyway, Lot, whenever the angels finally came to him, and this all happened, and they told him, we're going to destroy this place. And if I was one of those angels, I would have been ready to destroy that place too. If some dude was trying to come in and sodomize me, I would have been calling fire and brimstone down from heaven too. And he says, get out of this place because this whole thing's going to be destroyed. And Lot goes in there and he talks to his sons-in-law in Genesis 19 and verse 14. And he's telling them, you guys got to get out. I mean, there's fire and brimstone going to fall in this place and you're all going to die. And it says there in verse 14, and Lot went out and spake unto his sons-in-law, which married his daughters, and said, up, get you out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city. But he seemed as one that mocked unto his sons-in-law. He seemed as one that mocked. Why do you suppose that would be? It's because he never was a man of authority. He was never a man of his word before that. If he would have taken a stand on anything before that, he was wishy-washy. And when he finally comes and says, hey, we got to get out of here, and they're like, yeah, whatever, Dad. You know, yeah, we've heard all this stuff before. You know, we've heard your rantings and ravings or whatever. We know how serious you are about everything. He appears to them as one that mocked. And they ended up dying as a result of that. And Lot probably would have too if it wasn't for the angel. And I forget where the verse, oh, right here in verse 16, I think this is funny. Here old Lot, you know, they're going to rain fire and brimstone down in Sodom and Gomorrah. And you'd think that he'd be getting out immediately, post-haste. And in verse 16, and while he lingered, the men laid hold upon his hand, and upon the hand of his wife, and upon the hand of his two daughters, the Lord being merciful unto him, and they brought him forth and set him without the city. And they literally had to grab the guy by the hand and jerk him out of Sodom and Gomorrah. The Lord being merciful to him. You know, it's just, you'd think after all that, if I was God, I'd be like, you know what, just stay, fine. You want to stay, you want to linger, all right, whatever. Here's some fire and brimstone for you. But the Lord was merciful. So anyway, be like Abraham, husbands. Don't be like Lot. Don't be to your family whenever you tell them to do something and they're like, oh, Dad doesn't mean what he says and there's nothing behind it. It's just empty threats. Nothing's going to happen. Don't be like that. And mothers, for that matter, too. I mean, how many kids, how many parents tell their kids, if you don't do that, you're going to get a beating. And the kids are like, yeah, you're mocking because you're not going to do it. You never do it. Or if you don't do that, you're not going to grandma's house tomorrow because you got a sleepover plan. And they know, you're just talking. He's just one that mocks. He's not going to follow through with it. Why do you think the kids are out of control? Now ahead is a king. 1 Samuel 15 and verse 17. I know I've used this verse before whenever I'm proving that Jesus Christ, he is the head of the church and he's also the king of the church. This was back when Samuel was speaking to Saul. And Samuel identified Saul as the head and the king over Israel. In 1 Samuel 15:17, And Samuel said, when thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed thee king over Israel. So head and a king are the same thing. I mean, it makes sense, right? A king would be a person to whom others are subordinate. A chief, a captain, a commander, a ruler, a leader, a principal person, head man. I mean, that's a king, right? And the definition of head certainly fits king. So husbands, you're the head of your wives. You're the king. You're the king of your household. Now, a king ought not to be disrespectfully contradicted. If you look in the book of Ecclesiastes, Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 4, you think about it, ladies. Would you just contradict and disrespect a king? If King Obama came to your house, would you disrespect him? Okay, bad example. If another king came to your house, would you disrespect him? I doubt it, and you shouldn't disrespect King Obama either. But anyway, if a king came to your house, you would not want to disrespect him. You would show him honor and respect, I would hope. Ecclesiastes 8 and verse 4 said, where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say unto him, what doest thou? I mean, if you had a king sitting there on his throne, and he said, do thus and so, and you'd say, well, who are you to tell me what to do? What doest thou? Why are you making this command, king? That's not how it works. He'd take your head off. You know, now your husband can't take your head off, but anyway, you should still respect him as if he could. Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 20. Ecclesiastes 10:20. Ladies, so it's not just disrespecting your husband in person. Don't do it in private under your own breath either. Curse not the king, no, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber. For a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. I find it fascinating how many phrases in our everyday language we get from this old King James Bible. You ever hear somebody say, a little birdie told me? Where do you think that comes from? Right there, that's where it comes from. And this is a very real, actual thing now. It's called the NSA. You know, don't even under your thoughts. I mean, they got microphones on you everywhere, and so literally, I mean, if I'm not even like being a conspiracy theorist here, but if you really don't want anybody to know, make sure you're talking to yourself in your head. I don't think they can figure. They don't know that stuff yet. But don't speak something out loud if it's really something you don't want anybody else to know, because you just never know these days. They're listening to everything. And then I go say all this crazy stuff and put it on the internet. So anyway, I mean, if you just flood them with enough information, I suppose they can't, you know, sort through it all, and maybe they won't find me for a while. Now, 1 Peter 2 and verse 17. I can get my political commentary even on a sermon on marriage. 1 Peter 2 and verse 17. It says, honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Kings ought to be honored, so ought your husbands. Now, rather than disrespectfully contradicting a king should rather be entreated. That means you go to him softly and you ask, not demand. Proverbs 25 and verse 15. And this works well just in any area of life with anybody. You go up to anybody and demand something and see how much you're going to get. I mean, if you actually have the authority to force somebody to do something, yeah, you can demand. But generally in life, just demand to anybody. Call up an operator for some customer service line and demand something and see how well that goes for you. Whereas if you talk to them nicely, see how much more you might get from them. Proverbs 25 and verse 15. By long forbearing is a prince persuaded, and a soft tongue breaketh the bone. So ladies, you want to persuade your husband, long forbearing, soft tongue, not yelling and clamoring at him and disrespecting him. He's probably going to dig in his heels, and you're not going to get what you want anyway. And it's not going to be a fun place to live. Now, husbands, a king should take admonishment when it is deserved. Ecclesiastes 4 and verse 13. Ecclesiastes 4. In verse 13, it says, "Better is a poor and a wise child than an old and foolish king who will no more be admonished." So husbands, don't be that old and foolish king that can't be admonished. Don't be the guy whose kids couldn't possibly come to you and tell you that they think maybe a decision that you made wasn't the best and ask you, you know, why you made that decision or something. And to also to the kids, I had a couple of friends back in Cincinnati, and I thought that this was an excellent idea of something to adopt with your kids. They had a couple different things they did. One is they taught their kids, when they told them to do something, you do it, and the kids would have to do it before they could question it. There's no questioning. You say do it, and they do it. And then after they've done what you tell them to, then they can come back and say, "Why did you ask me to do that? You know, what was the reasoning to do that?" And, you know, I'm sure it took some beatings to get to that point, but it was amazing. They said do it, and the kids did it. And the other thing that they did is they would say, whenever they would call their kids' names, the kids would come, and they'd be right there. And they didn't ever have to, and there was no yelling and going across the house and trying to round them up. They just say, "Layla, Zazie," and it was, I mean, those kids were just right there. It was amazing. And like I said, I'm sure, it took some training to get them up to that point, but it was astounding. If you just, enough repetition and, it's like Pavlov's, that dog experiment, when you ding the bell and they start salivating or whatever. So anyway, I think that's a good thing to adopt with your kids. They can ask you why you made a decision after they've done what you tell them to do. You don't question me before you've done what I've told you to do. Sarah was a good example of this. She admonished Abraham, and guess what? God backed her up. If you look in Genesis 21, 9 through 12, Abraham was certainly not beyond reproach. And in this case, Sarah was right, and God told Abraham, "You listen to your wife." It's my paraphrase. In Genesis 21, 9 through 12, it says, "And Sarah saw the son of Hagar, the Egyptian, which she had borne unto Abraham, mocking. Wherefore she said unto Abraham, 'Cast out this bondwoman and her son, for the son of this bondwoman shall not be heir with my son, even with Isaac.' And the thing was very grievous in Abraham's sight because of his son. And God said unto Abraham, 'Let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad and because of thy bondwoman. And all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice. For in Isaac shall thy seed be called.'" So God actually took up the part of Sarah, and he said, "She's right, listen to her." So husbands, don't think that you're beyond reproach to where your wife can't suggest something to you. Especially if you are wrong and she points out the scripture to you, you better not resist that, because you're resisting God himself. Now, the husband's the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, in Ephesians 5:23. If you look at those words, those are pretty strong words there, even as. The word even means exactly, precisely, just. Now, chiefly archaic after biblical use and suggesting some notion of number nine, and you go to number nine, it says of man are often followed by as, thus so. So what they're saying here is number six is equal to number nine, and number nine says that it's followed by as. So even as, which is exactly the wording there in Ephesians 23, even as is defined as exactly, precisely, just. So when it says the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, he's saying the husband is the head of the wife exactly and precisely like Christ is the head of the church. Exactly is in a manner, is in a perfect manner, perfectly, to a perfect degree, to perfect, to perfection, completely. And precisely is definitely, entirely, absolutely. So like I said, this verse says that the husband is the head of the wife exactly, which is perfectly and completely, and precisely, which is definitely, entirely, absolutely, as Christ is the head of the church. So ladies, for you to not submit to your husband is tantamount to not submitting to Jesus Christ, because your husband is your head even as Christ is the head of the church. Let me say that again. For a wife not to submit to her husband would be tantamount to us as a church not submitting to Christ. There's the perfect parallel, because the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church. So if we as a church just decide, you know what, I don't really like this foot washing stuff, not to mention it's freezing, we're going to have icicles on our toes today, we're just not going to do it. That would be the same as a wife not submitting to her husband, because Christ is our head and we do what he says. As the church is to obey its head, which is Christ, so wives ought to obey their husbands. First of all, look in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. Just to show you that we, as the church, as Christians, are supposed to obey our head, Jesus Christ. 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 5. Casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalteth itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. And that's all I wanted, was just that last part there, that we are supposed to bring every, not only every action, even every thought to the obedience of Christ. So wives ought to obey their husbands. Look in Titus 2 and verse 5. I'm sure this is why Jason chose Trust and Obey for our hymn this morning. Titus 2 and verse 5. The older ladies are supposed to teach the younger women to be discreet, chaste, keepers at home, good, obedient to their own husbands, that the word of God be not blasphemed. So wives are supposed to be obedient. They're supposed to obey their husbands. And Sarah is our chief example of this. So Abraham was our example of a man that would command his household, right? And we looked at Abraham. Well, Sarah is likewise you ladies' example of somebody who obeyed her husband. We look in 1 Peter 3 and verse 6. 1 Peter 3 and verse 6 says, even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And I'll get to that second part later. I'm not going to read that part right now. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. Now, a Lord is a master, a ruler. It's a master of servants, the male head of a household. Number two, and I'll show you why at the end, you'll see why I've included number two. Number two, it's one who has dominion over others as his subjects, or to whom service and obedience are due, a master, chief, prince, sovereign, now only rhetorical, also lord and master, also a husband. That's part of the definition of number two. So in this sense, the husband is a lord. He's one that has the dominion, and people have to render obedience, or wives have to render obedience to. So I'm sure that modern dictionaries have changed some of these definitions around. I can't imagine that the modern woman would really appreciate a lot of this kind of stuff. This was not an outward show of submission, but rather it was something that Sarah said in her heart. Somebody would say, oh, yeah, yeah, sure. She called Abraham her Lord, probably in front of all of her Hebrew lady friends, you know, just to show how humble and pious she was, and said, oh, Abraham's my Lord, and blah, blah, blah. And in her heart, she's thinking, yeah, right, I'm not, you know, listening to what that old codger says. But that's not the case at all. Sarah said this in her heart. This is what she truly felt inside herself. Genesis 18 and verse 12. This is when God told Sarah that she was going to conceive and have a child at a very old age. And it says there in verse 12, therefore Sarah laughed within herself, saying, after I am waxed old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord being old also? Referring to Abraham. She's saying this, laughing in herself, calling Abraham her Lord, my Lord being old also. Because this is just her normal speech. That she's not even talking specifically about Abraham being her Lord. This is just how she generally refers to him. This is who he was to her. He was her Lord. And Christian women should imitate Sarah, as we saw there in 1 Peter 3 and verse 6. Or as we will see, pardon me. 1 Peter 3, 6, I'm going to read the second half of the verse now after I read the first half again. Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters ye are, as long as ye do well and are not afraid with any amazement. So like Sarah, though they should obey their husbands, they should not be put into such a state of fear by their husbands that causes them not to be able to think for themselves. So Sarah, yes, she called Abraham Lord. Yes, Abraham was her master. But if you want to be children, if you want to be daughters of Abraham or daughters of Sarah, ladies, then you're not, your submission doesn't go to the extent to where you are so fearful of your husband that you can't think for yourself. And neither should any husband ever have that kind of a relationship or rule over his wife that she is scared to even think for herself, suggest anything for herself, or anything like that. That is not the way it should be. And the definitions will bear me out here. It says you're not supposed to be afraid with any amazement. Amazement is the condition of being mentally paralyzed, mental stupefaction, frenzy. Stupefaction is the action of stupefying or state of being stupefied, numbness, torpor, or insensibility of body or mind. So you're not supposed to be afraid with any amazement, not with any mental paralyzation. You shouldn't be so afraid that you can't come to your husband to say something, or you just can't think for yourself, and he just has to tell you every little thing to do, and you wouldn't dare question anything. That is not biblical submission, and that is not what Sarah was either. And if you want to be her daughters, then you don't be afraid like that. And if you are, well, you the two of you need to come talk to me. We need to have some counseling sessions because that's screwed up. No woman should ever be treated in such a way that she can't think for herself. Now, as the church is to reverence Christ, so must wives reverence their husbands. You can see that the church is supposed to reverence Christ in Hebrews 12 and verse 28. Hebrews 12 and verse 28. It says, wherefore, we receiving a kingdom which cannot be moved, let us have grace whereby we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. So we are supposed to relate to God with reverence, and so ought wives to relate to their husbands with reverence in Ephesians 5 and verse 33. Ephesians 5 and verse 33. Says, nevertheless, let every one of you in particular so love his wife even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. Now, reverence is to salute a person with deep respect, to show respect for one by bowing, kneeling, etc., to make obeisance to treat with respect or deference, to esteem, to value highly. Okay, I'm not going to take this to any crazy extreme or anything. You don't need to be bowing and showing obeisance and that kind of thing. I think that would be a bit of a stretch. But what we can definitely take from that is that a wife, therefore, should respect, esteem, and value her husband highly. And men, you ought to do the exact same thing to your wives. And I will get into that next week. A wife should never insult, make fun of, or speak ill of her husband in public, or to other people privately also. That's one thing that you never want to do, wives, is ever degrade or put down your husband in front of anybody else, make fun of him for any reason, if you know, he has some weakness or whatever, don't bring that up in front of other people. And don't do it privately either. Don't get together with your girlfriends and run your husbands down and say what a jerk he is or what an idiot he is or something like that. You should never do that. And likewise, husbands, you should never do that to your wives either. I mean, you should never... run each other down and put each other down. You should be building each other up. And, you know, love covereth a multitude of sins. So if your husband or your wife does have some weakness, rather than exposing it to other people and making him look bad in their eyes, cover it up and try to make him look as good as you can. You know, and work with him to work on those issues so that he can become a better man. As the church views Christ as her Savior, So ought wives to view their husbands as their saviors, not spiritually, of course. I wanted to put that parenthesis in there just so nobody had any crazy ideas. Ephesians 5 and verse 23, not that any of you would have ideas like that anyway. But Ephesians 5, 23, for the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, and he is the savior of the body. But wives are, husbands are the saviors of their wives. I mean, they provide them with sustenance, they provide them with food and and money to purchase all this kind of stuff. They provide him with protection and safety and comfort and stability and all kinds of things. I mean, your husband definitely is your savior in a sense, for sure. Now, the principle of the headship of the husband over the wife was even recognized, as I mentioned this morning, in the pagan empire, the Medes and the Persians. And I'm not going to read through that again, but you'll remember what we read here just shortly ago, that you had King Ahasuerus there, and he was having a party with his buddies, and he called his wife Vashti to come out and, I don't know, just kind of walk the catwalk in front of him or something. She was a pretty woman, and he wanted to show off her beauty. I don't think it was any kind of a Victoria's Secrets pageant or anything like that, or I can understand why she wouldn't want to. I'm assuming he just wanted her to come out there and kind of parade around, and I don't know what her beef was that day. Who knows? But anyway, she didn't come. And the people realized, you know, she's just set a precedent here, and this word's going to get out to the other ladies in the kingdom, and they're all going to despise their husbands, and they're going to be emboldened by her rebellion to not submit to their husbands. So they came up with this idea, all right, let's get rid of Vashti, and let's bring you in another wife. And that's the name of the book, Esther. That's what happened. They brought in all these women, and there was like 50-some of them, wasn't there, or something like that anyway. And he got to try them all out or whatever. I don't know how all that stuff worked. But anyway, he found Esther and liked her the best, and she ended up being the queen and ended up saving the Jews. I mean, it's just a beautiful love story, and it's an amazing story of the providence of God. And you know what? It's the one book in the entire Bible where God's name is never mentioned. Not one time. Not God, Lord, anything. Not mentioned. Check it out. But God's providence certainly is just throughout the whole entire book. It's a beautiful book. You ought to read it sometime if you haven't. So anyway, Christian women today ought to take heed to that example back there and not be setting a bad example, setting a bad precedent for other women, especially younger women, to follow, because that's what the people were concerned about back then. So I found that interesting that in some of those cultures, women were worshipped as gods. Obviously, in this culture, it seems like they had a pretty good idea of man-husband-wife relationship, you know, that wives ought to submit to their husbands. So, and he didn't chop her head off or anything like that. So, I mean, he seemed like really pretty, I mean, I think you can learn some good Christian lessons even from heathens sometimes. Wives should be subject to their husbands as the church is subject unto Christ. In Ephesians 5 and verse 24, I probably sound like a broken record, but I am actually covering different verses and different things. But, you know, if I sound like a broken record, at least you will have gotten the point, hopefully. And you can't go away saying, I don't even know what the pastor is talking about today. You know, I hope you got it. Ephesians 5:24. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. So the church is supposed to, or the wives are supposed to be subject to their husbands as the church is subject unto Christ. Now you have that as word again. Now subject is that is under the dominion or rule of a sovereign, or a conquering or ruling power, owing allegiance or obedience to a sovereign ruler or state, a temporal or spiritual lord, or other superior. That's what it is to be subject to somebody, to be under their dominion and rule. Now, wives are to be subject to their husbands in everything. Do you see that? That doesn't leave much out. In everything. Everything, well, first I'll define every. It's used to express distributively the sense that is expressed collectively by all. So in other words, every means all. And everything is a combination of every and thing, hence it is the current substitute for all, or all things. So, you know, Newton, you know, big surprise here, everything means all things or all. So when it says there, that therefore as the church is subject unto Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything, they're supposed to be subject to their husbands in all things, in everything. Now, like the church is subject to Christ in all things, wives ought to be subject to their husbands in all things, so long as they are not in contradiction to God's law. And we know what Jesus said in Matthew 28:20, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. So, you know, a wife might ask, you know, what things should I submit to my husband in? My answer is very easy. everything, unless it's contradictory to God's law. So if he tells you, if he lays down a rule or tells you that he wants you to do something, he wants the kids to do something, then you need to submit to that. You know, don't come to me complaining that you don't like his rules. I mean, unless you can show me book, chapter, and verse where he's doing something sinful and wrong, then I'm not going to come to your aid and say, oh no, husband, you went too far on this one or something, you know, unless it's provable that he's not treating you the way that he should scripturally. Wives are even supposed to be in subjection to their own husbands, even if the husband is an unbeliever. And that would be a hard one. To somebody who's married to an unbeliever, you still got to submit to the guy. And he might not have the biblical wisdom as a believing husband would, and you're the believer and you understand the scriptures better, and he's making these boneheaded decisions that aren't necessarily sinful, but they just aren't wise decisions. You know, and here you got to submit to this guy. But you know, you're the one that said I do, so tough it out. 1 Peter 3 and verse 1. 1 Peter 3 and verse 1. This is really the main gist of what Peter's getting at here. The idea of a wife being married to an unbeliever, and he says she ought to submit anyway. 1 Peter 3 and verse 1, likewise ye wives, be in subjection to your own husbands, that if any obey not the word, they also may without the word be won by the conversation of the wives. Now subjection, I may have defined this before, I don't remember, but subjection is the act or state or fact of exercising lordship or control, dominion, domination, or control. Now if a Christian woman is married to an unbelieving husband, though he may not be won by the word, like witnessing the gospel to him, telling him about Jesus, he may not be won by that, but he may be won by the chaste conversation of the wife. That might be the best witnessing that a wife married to an unbeliever could be. I mean, she could have a pulpit every day being able to preach the gospel without saying a word, just by being a good and submissive wife and a chaste woman. Just by being that, she could end up converting her husband. verse 2 there, 1 Peter, continuing. While they behold your chaste conversation coupled with fear. And Paul talked about this also in 1 Corinthians 7:13, that if a believer is married to an unbeliever, you never know. Stick with them, because you may end up saving that person temporarily, of course. 1 Corinthians 7:13-14. Paul said, and the woman which hath an husband that believeth not, if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. And in verse 16 also, it says, for what knowest thou, O wife, whether thou shalt save thy husband? Or how knowest thou, O man, whether thou shalt save thy wife? So stick with them. Be a good wife, submit to him, and you never know. He may come around. He may see that there's something different about you, and that you are living out your religion, not just preaching at him, but you're actually doing what Jesus told you to do, and that may mean a lot more to him than any words that you may preach. It says there, where he beholds your chaste conversation. Conversation is the action of living or having one's being in a place or among persons. Also figuratively one's spiritual being. We think of conversation as when two people are talking together. But that's not in 1611 English. That's not what it means primarily. It's speaking of your action of living, your manner of life. What said your chaste conversation. Chaste is pure from unlawful sexual intercourse and incontinent. Yeah, be the opposite of that. Pure from unlawful sexual intercourse, continent, virtuous, of persons, their lives, conduct, etc. So, you know, be a pure wife and have your husband have no question about whether you are fidelitous to him, and that might go a long way to aid in his conversion. Continent is self-restraining or marked by self-restraint, especially in relation to bodily passions, appetites, or indulgences. Temperate. And virtuous was used in one of these words. I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah, and chaste. Virtuous is possessing or showing virtue in life and conduct, acting with moral rectitude or in conformity with moral laws, free from vice, immorality, or wickedness, good, just, righteous, of women, frequently it equals chaste. So that's why I used number two there for virtuous, because it cites that definition of chaste right in the definition. A wife's godly, self-restraining actions and attitude toward her husband can do more to bring about his conversion than the continual preaching of the gospel to him by an immoral and rebellious wife ever could. You think about it. You have some clamoring, rebellious wife that's bucking him at every turn, but he's saying, oh, you should obey Jesus. And he's like, oh, yeah, why don't you? You know, I mean, think about it, hypocrite. So that's not going to do a whole lot. It's better to live in a corner of a housetop than with a brawling and how's it say it, a brawling and loud and brawling woman? No, that's not right. Brawling and something woman anyway. There's a couple of those proverbs. Better to live in the wilderness than with a brawling woman in a... No, better to live in a corner of a housetop than with a brawling woman in a wide house. And then the other one is something about living in the wilderness. And I'm not going to go there because Jason's already smiling at me. So I'm going to save face before I start digging. All Christian women should maintain a godly, chaste, and virtuous manner of life at all times, not just those who have unbelieving husbands. So, you know, if you say, well, that verse doesn't apply to me because I have a believing husband, therefore I'm going to be unchaste and lewd, you know, that's not going to work, ladies, just in case you didn't know that. Wives should be concerned with how they can please their husbands. In 1 Corinthians 7, 34, and husbands, before you get on your high horse and get all smiles, you're supposed to be concerned about how you can please her too. So like I said, I'm going to get on you next time. So you're going to be on cloud nine after this sermon, and then your wives are going to be able to get back at you after the next one. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 34. There is a difference also between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman careth for the things of the Lord, how she may be holy both in body and spirit. And she that is married, but she that is married, careth for the things of the world, how she may please her husband. So if you're married and you're not single, then it is your responsibility to care for how you would care for the things of the world to please your husband. You would not be right to spend all your time with your nose in the Bible and not doing everything else you're supposed to do for your husband and for your family. You should care for the things of your husband and of the world if you're married. A wife's number one priority, except for God, of course that is, a wife's number one priority should be her husband, and the husband should be his wife, and I'll get into that later. But the woman's number one priority should be her husband. That should be your number one priority, ladies. Not your career, or not even your children, for that matter. A woman's children should come after your husband. Because you're going to have your husband for a long time. Your kids are going to grow up and move away. But you're going to have your husband forever. And remember, you and your husband chose each other before you chose your kids. As a matter of fact, you didn't even choose your kids. You chose each other. You didn't. You just got the kids. You got whatever, you know, God gave you in that regard. So your husband ought to be your number one priority. There are too many women, and sometimes men too, but especially women, there are too many women that are so wrapped up in their kids that when their kids are finally gone, they have no relationship left with their husband. I mean, their whole marriage, their whole life is wrapped up in the kids, to where the husband and wife don't even really talk or get along anymore. And then when the kids are gone, the wife's devastated, because her whole life is gone, and then she's got this guy that she doesn't even, for the last 20 years, she doesn't even know him because she's been so wrapped up in the kids. And it can work the other way, too. But that's the wrong answer. That is the wrong answer. And lastly today, wives should provide for the sexual needs of their husbands, too. That is one of the duties of the wife, and it's the same thing for you husbands. And like I said, I'll get at you next time. 1 Corinthians 7, 3 through 5. Said, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that ye may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. So this is a commandment from God. It's not some kind of an optional suggestion. And there's a lot of men out there that don't hardly get anything, sexually speaking, and that's wrong. I mean, it's you wives, let me just put it bluntly, ought to put out. That's your duty before God, and likewise the husbands. I mean, that's not something to be taken lightly. A man's wife should provide for his sexual satisfaction and no other. And if a man's wife provides for it, the chances of him going somewhere else to find it are going to be much less slim. And that's not excusing any husband for going anywhere else, no matter what he's getting at home. But still, just think about it. He's going to have a lot less reason to go looking somewhere else. For, in Proverbs 5, 15 through 17. Drink waters out of thine own cistern, and running waters out of thine own well. Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad, and rivers of waters in the streets. Let them be only thine own, and not strangers with thee. Let thy fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Let her be as the loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravished with a strange woman, and embrace the bosom of a stranger? A man's needs, a man's sexual needs, ought to be provided for his wife. Her breast ought to satisfy him at all times, and none other. Now, withholding sex should never be used as a method of punishment or revenge on the part of the wife or the husband. That is definitely a no-no. The idea, oh, you're upsetting me, you're not spending the time with me or whatever, so I'm not going to give you any sex, that is wrong. That is absolutely wrong. That should not be done. That is a part of your duty that God commands you, just like any other of the numerous commandments in His Word. Something that you ought to do. And if you need to work on it, then work on it. And this, not this last point, but this topic of marriage really goes well into the communion service, into the communion meditation. Because if you turn to Ephesians 5, where we spent a lot of the time today, you see there that it's very plain that marriage, as I mentioned last time, is a picture of Christ and His bride. It's a picture of Christ and the church and what Christ did for the church. Ephesians, we'll start at verse 25 and we'll read down through verse 32. It says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave Himself for it, that He might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word, that He might present it to Himself a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that it should be holy and without blemish. So ought men to love their wives as their own bodies. He that loveth him, loveth his wife, loveth himself. For no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife. And they too shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. So this great mystery here, which Paul speaks of in marriage, he is ultimately speaking of Christ and the church. When he's talking about husbands loving your wives and giving yourself for them, the greater picture there is Christ and the church. This, the plans for this marriage of Christ and the church, you know how wedding plans generally take a long time? Well, these wedding plans took a really long time, like started before the foundation of the world, and thousands of years later, the wedding finally took place. And then the reception, the great marriage feast, is going to be thousands of years in the future. So God's wedding is kind of spread out a little bit. But as we see in Ephesians 1 and verse 4, the plans for this wedding started way back before the foundation of the world. It says in Ephesians 1 and verse 4, according as He hath chosen us in Him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before Him in love. God chose a people, His elect, in Christ before the foundation of the world, that Christ should make them holy and without blame. They were going to be His bride. And Christ, way back then, before any of these people were ever actually created, in covenant, He agreed to be their husband, to be their bride. And he came in due time, and he died for all of the sins of all of his people for all time, and made them his bride, made them his bride in white. That's why the bride is supposed to be in white, because she's pure, right? She's free from defilement. And that's why Christ's bride can be in white, clothed in white, because Christ made us that way. And one day, this is just, this right here, what we're doing, what we're going to do this morning, this is just a little foretaste of what is going to happen one day. This little supper here, one day we're going to have a supper up there. It's called the Marriage Supper of the Lamb. You can see it in Revelation 19, 7 through 9. That's going to be the culmination of all these pictures that we've had of all the churches, all the ages, all the times that we've commemorated this supper. It's the picture of this great and final supper where when we're all rejoined, reunited with God in heaven. Revelation 19, 7 through 9 said, "Let us be glad and rejoice and give honor to him, for the marriage of the Lamb is come, and his wife hath made herself ready. And to her was granted that she should be arrayed in fine linen, clean and white. For the fine linen is the righteousness of saints. And he saith unto me, Write, blessed are they which are called unto the marriage supper of the Lamb. And he said unto me, These are the true sayings of God." And thank God that we've been called unto that marriage supper. And one day, we're going to be up there and we're going to have the greatest communion feast, the greatest marriage supper of the Lamb ever. And it's all because Christ loved us and gave himself for us to present us to God, a glorious church, not having spot or wrinkle or any such thing.